Welcome to Radio Naturopath. This is a call-in talk show about health and natural medicine. It's April 3rd, 2019. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. I'm here with my co-host, Ron Meniza. If you'd like to participate in the conversation about natural medicine, you can call 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also check out my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch ND. All right, so it's lovely to be here. I had been talking about menopause the last couple of weeks, and I talked about the pros and cons of hormone replacement therapy. And of course, with hormone replacement therapy, if you are going to do it at all, the best is to do bioidentical hormones. And we did figure out that there was a good study that showed that when you do estrogen therapy along with natural progesterone, not with a synthetic progestin or a synthetic progesterone, but with natural progesterone and estrogen therapy, your risk of reproductive cancer is the same as if you didn't do it at all. So it doesn't lower it, but it doesn't raise it. Whereas if you do estrogen-based therapy alone, or if you do synthetic progesterone with or without estrogen, it raises your, in fact, doing synthetic progesterone along with plain estrogen therapy is more likely to cause you reproductive cancer than doing estrogen therapy alone. How interesting is that? So synthetic progestin is not a good thing. Whereas natural progesterone is anti-inflammatory, synthetic progestin probably has some pro-inflammatory issues. So the deal is that it's stimulating your progesterone receptors, but it's doing it wrong. Something is going wrong there. It's making it so, of course, that progesterone can't bond. Whereas if you just take estrogen, even if you're in menopause and you're not particularly making a lot of estrogen, there may be some progesterone around that's maybe being made from through pathways from estrogen, from your own DHEA, from cortisol, from androgens. There's not much, because when you try to measure progesterone in menopausal women, you don't see a lot in their blood. And you tend to feel better when you have progesterone around. So anyway, what I wanted to talk about today is delivery systems. And that's something I didn't manage to talk about. So sometimes women are given pills. The issue with being given pills for natural progesterone, for natural hormones, is that when you take a pill, you have to, it has to get into your stomach, and then it has to get into your circulation. And when it gets through your stomach, it goes through your circulation, and then it goes through your liver, and it's broken down by enzymes in your liver before it gets into your blood. So you wind up having to take higher doses of it because of that first liver pass. So some women take, they take estrogen, and they take progesterone orally, and it's not too, and it works for them. I would say it's not a great idea. If you can do estrogen another way that's not oral, I think that's better. My opinion here is that more estrogen is going to get into your body because you have to do that first liver pass. And so the estrogen is going to be hanging around in the liver. And remember that estrogen is a proliferative hormone. And a lot of us have spent lives in estrogen dominance, and, you know, women struggle to not be estrogen dominant. And the reason for that is there are xenoestrogens in the environment. There's estrogen-like compounds in the environment that our liver is always having to look at and that we're always having to manage. And if you're stressed, if you're under any kind of stress, which most of us are not in the 1%, most of us are in the 99%. So most of us are stressed and have to work hard and have a lot of things that we do in our lives. So the progesterone that we make when we're in our cycling years, that means our
not the ones when you're on the bicycle.
I didn't mean that. No,
right?
No,
right.
I'm still in those cycling years.
Not the pedaling years.
I'm talking about the reproductive cycling years. When you're in the reproductive cycling years, you make natural progesterone every month when you ovulate. So that natural progesterone, if you're under stress, one of the things that can happen to it is it's very easily 2-step procedure to convert it to cortisol, and cortisol is your fight or flight hormone. And if you're under any kind of fight or flight, you're going to be making cortisol out of your progesterone, which will leave you estrogen dominant. So like I said, a lot of us have spent a lot of years in estrogen dominance, which means that that liver is exposed to a little too much estrogen all those years. And it's the liver's job to take that estrogen and metabolize it so you don't have so much around. So one of the things you see is that women get cysts on their liver, and those cysts may be caused by too much estrogen around. And in fact, it's known that when women take chemical contraception, whether it's, it's some estrogen-based chemical contraception, whether it's pills or implants or a NuvaRing or, any kind of estrogen-based contraceptive, that you're more likely that you'll see liver cysts is one of the side effects. Why are liver cysts happening? Easy, because estrogen is a proliferative hormone. It causes overgrowth of cells. And so because that's happening, that's evidence that women spend time in estrogen dominance. And even if you're not taking chemical contraception, if you're estrogen dominant, you're more likely to get liver cysts. And the liver cysts are not harmful. It's just that they take up space, and the cells that are making cysts, they can't really do anything. They can't do all the cool things that the liver does, like, for example, manage your hormones or detoxify you or manage your glycogen, protein, or fats in your body. All of your macronutrients get processed through the liver. Like I said a million times, Dr. Titchrid used to say, he's our anatomy professor, he used to say that letters should not be signed, love, Ron. They should be signed, hepatically yours, Ron. Because he felt that...
What?
He felt that the liver was more important than the heart.
Oh, jeez.
Well, it does a lot more things.
Was that the guy with the...
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, he was my anatomy professor.
Right.
I've
met him.
No, you never met him. No, you never met Dr. Titchrid.
Okay, I didn't meet him.
You're talking. Are you thinking about Dr. Khalsa?
Maybe.
Okay, you met Dr. Khalsa. You met Dr. Khalsa at Powell's on Hawthorne, but no, you never met Dr. Titchrid. Is in heaven. I'm not sure when he went to heaven, but he went.
But before I had a chance to meet him.
Oh yeah. Well, Dr. Titchrid was my teacher in 1991 and 1992. And I don't know how old he was. He was an older gentleman at the time, and he probably went to heaven between then and now. And I don't know what happened there.
Okay.
But Dr. Khalsa, you met. Yeah, he's a nice guy. Mm-hmm. Guru Sundish Sir Singh Khalsa. I sat and listened to that man many hours at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. He taught me things like pathology, and I think he taught me clinical physical diagnosis, and he taught me immunology. And he was a nice guy. He was a lot of fun. He was born in California. He said that all Californians are issued a frisbee at birth. He was a funny man.
I think that's probably true.
He was very low key, but he was also very, very, very smart. He was sort of low key and not low key.
They actually print the birth certificates on the frisbees.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, it's very good. Eric told me when I was in Oregon and Washington, so he said that San Francisco is so expensive you can't afford to live there. That San Francisco is ridiculous right now.
It is.
Because all the IPOs are going there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the IT IPOs.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that whole Silicon Valley thing.
Oh, my goodness. So,
yeah, it's kind of crazy there.
Yeah. So anyway, the point is, if you take a pill that has estrogen in it, it's going to go through a first liver pass. And if you also have a lifetime of being exposed to extra estrogen, then you're going to be more likely to get liver cysts. And you're more likely to have, you're more likely to have had a lifetime of exposure to too much estrogen. I think it's not a great idea to do estrogen orally. That the way to get your estrogen is by other means. And so what are the ways that you can get estrogen into your body? Well, there are lots of nice delivery systems. There are creams you can do, and the creams can be placed they can be placed on your abdomen. Usually when you get a hormone replacement cream, it's placed on your breasts, your abdomen, your thighs, your arms, and you alternate sites so you don't get a depot of too much hormone in any one spot. What a depot is just what it sounds like. When you apply something to an area, whether in a cream or whether by injection, it sets up in the fat and it slowly releases. That's what a depot is. And so when you are placing cream on your arm or your breast or your abdomen, it's absorbing into the fat, and then it's going to slowly release from that area, from a depot, because there's a little deposit there.
Yeah, right. So. It's a little place for it to stop, which is a depot.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, a depot meaning a place that comes from deposit. Right. So I think that's a better option. And so that's one delivery system. So estrogen and progesterone do well there. Now, if you're a woman and you're doing hormone replacement therapy and you have a sex drive issue and your doc says maybe it would be nice for you to have testosterone, what you do is you get pretty low-dose testosterone. You get it in a cream and you put it right where it's going to do some good. So you put it right on your vulva, and most people put it right on their clitoris, and you don't need very much at all. You need a pea-sized amount, really, and it's not very much. And women find that if they use testosterone, they may not even need to use it every day. So it depends on the dose. It is helpful for sex drive. It can be very nice. And it is helpful for energy and dry. Like if you're feeling that draggy feeling that you get during menopause, some of it could be because your testosterone is too low. And so your doctor will monitor your testosterone levels by blood and make sure that you're not getting too much on board. And then there's the reference range, and then there's the optimal range. And the optimal range is a little bit higher than the reference range, because the reference range for women is it's 2 to 45 nanograms per milliliter. It's not very much at all, whereas the reference range for men is somewhere from 200 to 1100. Their testosterone is much, much higher, which explains a lot.
What are you trying to say?
Yeah, right. Right. So you have a little... Now, not to say that women in menopause don't have sex drives, because they can, but a lot of women... I would say that it's fair to say that most women struggle with sex drive in menopause, especially if they're still in their work lives and they're running around and they're exhausted, because any extra hormone that you have is going to go towards making cortisol so you can do your fight or flight, so you can do your activities. And your body's just not focused on making reproductive hormones for you anymore. So if you don't have a big chance of getting reproductive cancer, so if you have a risk of reproductive cancer, it's probably not a great idea to take proliferative hormones. And there may be some disagreement about that in Europe, because they're more likely to use hormone replacement therapy in Europe. But if you don't have risk, then if you take proliferative hormones, estrogen and testosterone, and you pair that with natural progesterone, whether you take oral micronized progesterone, if that works for you, I think that's okay, because it's easy to do. It does do the first liver pass, but progesterone is an anti-proliferative hormone. So if it goes through your liver and it goes through your digestive system, I think that's a good thing. So if you do oral, because you can get oral micronized progesterone in peanut oil, and it's very nice. And of course, if you're peanut allergic, you can't get it in peanut oil, and you might be able to get a compounding pharmacist to put it in something else. But you can also do progesterone cream. The other way you can do natural progesterone, which is very nice, is to do a sublingual oil. So it's put in an oil, and then you put it under your tongue when you go to bed at night. And it's relaxing, and it gets in, and it does avoid the first liver pass as long as you let it sit under your tongue, because it gets into the blood vessels under your tongue. So that's a nice way to do it, and I feel like you get better control over the dose when you do that than you have during the cream, because the cream, you're not sure how much you're getting out exactly. I mean, you're going to get an exact amount of cream out if you're using a syringe, but the absorption, I think, can be variable. And yet there are women who use natural progesterone cream and it works great for them. So if that's your gig, that's a fine thing. But I really am a fan of the sublingual oil. So that's something you can talk to your doc about prescribing and getting the compounding pharmacist to make up for you. If you don't like the taste, progesterone oil tends to taste a little bit bitter. So guess what? You can ask for flavor. So your pharmacists are just only too excited to make your compound more pleasurable
flavored
for you. Yes, you can get it flavored. Yes, my natural progesterone is raspberry. It's very nice. So that was the one. Mona Morstein, who's a colleague of mine, she's a well, actually a rather well-known naturopath. She's written books and stuff, and she likes raspberry-flavored progesterone. That's her gig. But I think you can get it in other flavors, too. You know, when you want to make a compound palatable, you put some stuff in it. You know, when we make our chicken, we don't want plain chicken usually, right?
No.
No. We want Doug's sauce, or we want, you know, curry, or we want something interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we flavor it. Well, you can do that with your medicine, too. You know, just a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down.
Yeehaw.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mary Poppins.
Uh-huh. In the most delightful way. Okay. So, anyway, so sublingual oil. And then the other thing, the other big thing that happens to women is we get some degree, not everybody, but a lot of women complain of vaginal atrophy. And even if in their everyday lives, their vulvas are fine, like you walk. Some women have so much vaginal atrophy that it hurts to walk. Yes.
Really?
Oh, yes. They get chafing really, really bad. Yes. And not everybody is like that, but some women do get that. And so if you're in that situation, then topical estrogen is going to be a good thing. And so your doc might prescribe to you either estradiol or estriol. And the estradiol has a little bit longer half-life. It's the stronger. Remember, there are three estrogens in our body, E1, E2, and E3. Estrone and estradiol are the stronger estrogens, and estriol is the weakest of the three. And your body predominates in the estriol because estrogen is a very strong proliferative hormone. And so proliferative hormones, if they overstimulate your tissues, you can get tissue overgrowth and you can get tumors. So most of your estrogen is going to be the weaker form, so you prevent that from happening. Well, if you take estriol cream and you put it right where it's needed, like right on your vulva, it's going to cause some nice regrowth of the tissues, and you'll be able to make moisture, and intercourse will be more comfortable. And the neat thing about estriol is because it's weaker, it has a shorter half-life, and so there's virtually no absorption into the general circulation. With estradiol, there's going to be a little bit, but even though the doses that they use for topical estradiol are still pretty low, and it's even used in women who've had reproductive cancer before. However, my preference is to use the estriol, because the estriol, the other thing, the neat thing about estriol is you can get it over the counter. You can get estriol cream over the counter. And if you apply it topically, it's going to make you more comfortable. So that's my preference there. One more thing that we check on, we talked about DHEA, dihydroepiandrosterone. So DHEA can be gotten over the counter, and it can be put in your compounded cream. So if you're getting if a compounding pharmacy is making a compound for you, and you want one and done, you can get everything put in the cream. You can get a cream that has all of your stuff in it. It can have your estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, and DHEA in it. That can be compounded for you, and you just put that on every day or every couple of days or whatever your directions are, and that can be really helpful for you. But, you know, if you want to have control over the separate components, and that's what I tend to prefer personally. You know, I've preferred to do progesterone, and, you know, I want it because I may not want the progesterone every day. I may not want my patient to take the testosterone every day, and the patient may not need the estriol. Once they get the estriol on board topically, they may not need it every day. So if you don't mind having the separate components, it can be really helpful for you. So that you can, and then you have control over what's going on. If your sex drive is just fine today, thank you very much, maybe you don't need to take your DHEA and your testosterone, because with these things, less is more. So if you find it's always a good idea for whatever compound you're taking to take the lowest effective dose. And so, you know, with something like testosterone, if your sex drive is good today, you may not need to take it tomorrow. So that's a good thing. The only other thing with topical hormones that you have to be concerned about is transmitting them to your partner. I did have a case where a gentleman came in, and he was having some irritability and anxiety, and he was having some symptoms he didn't like, and we were monitoring his salivary hormones, and we discovered that his estrogen was really high. And you know what we figured out? We figured out it was being transmitted to him because his wife was using a topical estrogen cream. So once we figured that out, we gave the gentleman some great stuff to help to remove the estrogen from his body. We gave him diindolyl methane, which is
Really weird.
I know, right? You have to be careful of that. So we gave him diindolyl methane, which is an extract of indole 3 carbinol, which comes from broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables, that helps you to excrete your estrogens. We gave him that, and we had them be more careful about where the woman put her estrogen cream, mm-hmm. And so that it wasn't transmitted to him. And then a month or so later, he was all better. It was nice, and so he got his balance of hormones back, and he was happier. And that's what happened. So you have to be careful with the transmittal of that. You know, docs will tell you, depending on where it's applied, how long to wait. For example, if you're applying stuff on the vulva, you probably want to have, if you're going to have intercourse anywhere near that, you want to probably have intercourse first and then clean up and then apply your estrogen cream to the vulva and then not have intercourse for a while after that. I was told once, wait at least 2 hours. But if you're applying testosterone to yourself, if you're applying testosterone to your vulva and then you're going to have intercourse with a man, then probably doesn't matter because the amount of testosterone, it's going to be a drop in the bucket for the man. However, they do recommend you wait 2 hours so you're not affecting his testosterone. So when guys use natural hormone replacement therapy, they're generally not applying the compounds to the genitals. They're generally told to apply it to their armpits. And they do the armpits because, again, that's a place where if you're with your partner, you're probably not going to transmit it. But again, you have to be careful, and you want to, you know, if you're a guy and you're taking topical testosterone, you want to make sure that you're taking it at a time where you're not going to transmit it to a partner. So the other thing, if you are in a same-sex couple, you have to determine if that same-sex couple is going to be affected. Whether you want that same-sex partner to be affected by your hormones. And again, you still have to you have to make that decision, and then you have to apply your creams and your lotions and your topicals at a time that's away from when you're going to have intercourse. So the benchmark is at least 2 hours. And what I tell people is, depending on when you're planning to have intercourse, do your hormones 12 hours away from that. So if you like to have intercourse or have sex play in the morning, do your stuff at night, and if you like to have it at night, do it in the morning. And if you skip, so if you did it in the morning, if you did it already, what you want to try to do is you have to plan for that event. If you're planning to put it on at night, and then you wind up, if you wind up having intercourse or sex play, you put it on after that. But if you're going to be intimate with the person through the night, then I think it's okay to just skip the night and wait till the morning. So, or wait till you're done and wait till the time when you're not going to have as intimate contact for a little while. So, that's about topical stuff. So, you might be getting creams that you're going to apply to the body where you're going to rotate sites like breasts and belly and arms and thighs and things like that. And you might be getting sublingual, like progesterone comes in a sublingual oil version. That's very nice. And DHEA generally, DHEA can be put in a topical cream if it's compounded, but it can be gotten over the counter and taken orally. And progesterone can be gotten over the counter, but it also can be prescribed in specific doses and compounded. And it's going to be, if it's a sublingual oil, it's going to be in, generally it's going to be prescribed. There are companies that make sublingual oils in non-prescription doses. So that is actually available over the counter. You can get estriol, estradiol, DHEA, and progesterone in small amounts over the counter. And DHEA is generally easily found as a supplement orally, and it works orally. It does the first liver pass, and it works. So, all right, so that's what's going on with delivery systems for hormone replacement therapy. So that's what I wanted to talk about today. All right, so now I just got back from Oregon and Washington, and I really sort
Yay,
of, I
back.
Sort of, I know. So I sort of divided my time between Oregon and Washington. As it happened, I was staying with my dear friend Eric, and he put me up in his place in Vancouver. So Vancouver is immediately, literally immediately north of Portland. So in fact, it's immediately.
Turn over that bridge.
That's right. Over the, well, right. Yeah,
just you, like a bridge you go over. And you're,
there's a couple of bridges. There's a few bridges because you can go over on the I-5. You can go over on the 205.
I've always gone over on the I-5.
Well, it depends where you're going. Right. I mean, if you're going to, because that's what I found out, because I was using my GPS, and depending where I was headed in Portland, it sent you different ways. So if you go over the I-5, you wind up in Northwest. That's where it drops you off. You can either, when you go over the I-5, you wind up on the 405. I sound like the Californians. You go
you
over.
Do. You sound like that episode from Saturday Night Live. Very nice.
Yeah. Right. So you go over the I-5 and it puts you onto the 405 and you wind up in Northwest. So you go over you might go over the Fremont Bridge, that's on the 405. Or you might drop on the I-5 and you'll drop into Northwest Portland in a different spot. If you if you take the 205, the 205 puts you in Northeast. So it depends where you're going. So what happened to me is I landed. I got my car and then I went straight to Vancouver, and the airport is right on the border. It's
right.
Yeah. And so, and it's right on the 205 is that it puts you onto the 205. That's what's right there. So you take 205 and you go right into Vancouver, and I went to Vancouver and hung out with Eric, and that was very nice. And then, I got there Wednesday, and, on Thursday I did something very interesting. I went to Carson Hot Springs. So one of the things about the Northwest is that the Northwest has thermal activity. There's a lot of there's big mountains there, and one of the beautiful things about being in Greater Portland is you turn your head to the east, and if you're lucky, you see Mount Hood, which I did. You know, the sky was clear enough at various times that I was able to look to the east and see Mount Hood. And if you're on the I-5 bridge or the I-205 bridge, those are north-south bridges. So if you turn your head to the east, it's right there, and it's enormous, and it's 50 miles away. That's the thing, but it's so big that you see it. So those, and then depending where you are, when you fly in, certainly, you can see Mount St. Helens. And Mount St. Helens looks weird because the top is blown off.
It is.
Everybody remembers, I think it was 1980 or 81 when it blew up. And it blew the top off, and Yakima, Washington was covered in soot. Anyway, it's still blown off. But right now, the top of those mountains are covered in snow. So this time of year, Eric said, it's nice to be able to look to the east because you can see them and they're snow-capped. Okay. And then what you watch as the spring advances and you advance into the summer, you watch the snow level recede. And the opposite happens when it gets to be September, October, that you see your first snow, and then the snow descends until it's covered in snow, and then after a while you can't see it because it's raining. So and you can't see.
Oh yeah, that thing.
Yes. So I had a lot of good weather when I was there. I had more beautiful days than not. I think the first day I got there was a little rainy, and the last day I got there was a little rain. And even, I think that was it. The first day was the rainiest, and the rest of them, I had some gorgeous days. I had close to, 70-degree weather. I think it went over 70 a couple of days. I happened to hit it right. And the spring is ahead of where we are here. So when I was flying in, I saw that there were lots of trees with flowers on them. You know, there were dogwood trees and different trees with pink flowers on them, and that was lovely, and other trees with white flowers on them.
I'm ready.
Yeah, I know, right?
I know.
And so around on the ground, there were some wildflowers and weeds with flowers that had bloomed, and some of the Oregon grape and Mahonia had yellow flowers on it, and that was nice. But I noticed that, I was there on the last day of March through, the last days of March until April 1st. I remember when I lived there, usually by the 20s of the March in the 20s, the leaves were all out on the trees. There are deciduous trees there and the leaves would be out. Well, this was not the case this time. And I mentioned this to Eric and he said, well, we had kind of a, and I talked to my friend Jill as well, and they had kind of a strong, intense winter this year. So the spring is a little bit delayed, but it is not delayed relative to us. We are definitely behind them And that's par for the course here. We usually don't see leaves on the trees until the beginning of May. So I expect that that will be similar this year. However, the pollen is fat and happy right now. There's loads of pollen in the air right now. And if
here.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Both
yeah,
places.
The counts are really high, right now. Yeah.
They are really high, and it's because your trees are budding. And so they're kicking out pollen, and they're getting excited because they're making flowers. They're going to be, the trees will start making flowers probably in a month or maybe a little bit less. But that's why there's a lot of pollen right now. Anyway, when I was in Oregon and Washington, one of the things about that thermal activity is those mountains, Mount Hood, Mount St. Helens, Mount Adams, Mount Jefferson, and there's a couple others with president names. Those mountains are all volcanoes, and they could blow at any time.
They could.
St.
It
Helens
can all happen.
And St. Helens did. With and you know, I think there were some casualties because of St. Helens, but it wasn't too bad. However, you know, man could blow, but they haven't. And the neat thing, the upside of that is when you live near volcanoes, you get thermal activity, and the thermal activity will give you nice hot mineral water. So there are numerous opportunities to go and enjoy hot springs, and there are natural hot springs, and then there are resorts that get the hot spring water into a place where you can go be in it. So I had read that the natural hot springs, like Bagby Hot Springs, which is near Mount Hood, that they don't maintain it until April. So I wasn't going to go there because it was still March, and that it might be snowed in still. And some of the other natural places, Terwilliger, otherwise known as Cougar, in the Willamette National Forest, had a fire and also could also be snowed in. So I wasn't going to take my chances, but Carson is available. Carson is easily accessible. It's in Carson, Washington. And you go to, you travel to Stevens. Stevens is on the, on Route State Highway 14. And they have a State Highway 14 like they do here. And so you go off 14 and then you hang a left and then you wind up in Stevens and you go a little ways and then you wind up in the little town of Carson. And Carson is basically the hot springs. There are some natural hot springs in a river, it may be called the Wind River, that is a river off the Columbia River, that you can go in, and they're natural hot springs. I didn't attempt to do that, but they may have been accessible and easy to do. I'm not sure. But I didn't try that. But I went to Carson, and Carson is a little resort, and it has a lodge, a place where you can stay. And then it's really old-timey, and it has a building. It has a men's bathhouse and a women's bathhouse. And there's all these clawfoot bathtubs set up. And you, for a relatively inexpensive rate, you pay some money and you get to go and take a 25-minute bath in the hot spring water. They provide you with towels. There's hot and cold water. So I found that I was getting hot when I was in the tub because it was nice hot water and it's detoxifying. So I want, and they provide you with, you know, three sizes of towel. So I took the washcloth and I rinsed it in cold water and put it on my head. And periodically I would sit up and I just wipe down my head and my chest and my arms with the cold water and then sit back down into the hot water. And so that was alternating hot and cold. And so it's wonderful mineral water. And they tell you all the different components that are in the water. I may have a photo. Yeah, they tell you all the different, there's definitely sulfur compounds in the water. And, if I can find it, I'll tell you. But there's definitely sulfur. There's definitely potassium. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of nice minerals.
And so when you're laying in this, you're absorbing it right through your pores.
Yes, you're getting some absorption of it. So I just found it. So I actually, there's a spigot outside. So if you would like to take some hot spring water home, you can. And so I did. I took a bottle of it home, but then I didn't finish it. And so I left it with Eric. But you can drink it. Then they do encourage you to drink it while you're in the tub if you want to. So here's what's in it, because I took a picture. That under the spigot, they tell you exactly what's in it. So in the Carson mineral water is potassium, And it tells you what the potassium is good for. Releasing energy from your cells, manufacturing of glycogen and protein. Glycogen is your storage form of sugar that hangs out in your liver for use. And also protein, which you need for all the cells in your body, all the, you know, structure in your body. Regulates your fluid balance. Transmission of nerve impulses. It's important in maintaining normal heartbeat and also for muscle contractions. The mineral water has sodium. It maintains normal fluid balance, transmission of nerve impulses, muscle contraction, and helps to increase the permeability of your cell walls. So if you want stuff to get in and out of your cells, nutrients, you know, your sugars, your proteins, your messengers, your minerals, your cells have to be able to open up to them. There's calcium in the water, which helps with the development and maintenance of strong bones and teeth. Of course, preventing against osteoporosis, ensures proper blood clotting. It's needed for contraction and relaxation of muscles, especially the heart. Calcium is needed for your iron utilization. You need calcium to assist in the absorption of vitamin B12. And it also helps to regulate your cellular permeability. Cell membranes have calcium channels on them that open and close to let stuff in and out. Their mineral water has magnesium, which, of course, helps to form strong bones and teeth, regulate muscle relaxation and contraction, maintains proper function of your nerves, and activates enzymes that control your energy metabolism. There, of course, is sulfate, because when you go to the hot springs, it always smells like, you know, sulfur. It smells kind of eggy. And sulfate you need to maintain healthy hair and nails. So when you have curly hair, you have disulfide bonds, and the disulfide bonds are what keep the shape of the proteins in that curly form. It's needed for eliminating blood diseases, so it's detoxifying. It helps to eliminate some skin diseases. Again, sulfur is part of a lot of detoxifying compounds. It stimulates the liver and increases flow of bile. It's important in maintaining normal body metabolism, and it detoxifies some poisons in the body. So a lot of compounds in the liver, like glutathione and glucarate, have sulfur in them, and also sulfate itself by itself is detoxifying. So sulfur is a very nice structural and detoxifying mineral. And of course, whenever you go to any kind of hot springs, or if you go to Yellowstone, it smells like sulfur. There's always sulfur in the water there. Also, if you go to Florida, there's in the groundwater in Florida, there's a lot of sulfur. So when you see if you get city water and you don't filter it, it will taste like sulfur. And also if you just, when people are watering their lawns, it smells like eggs. All right. So there's also phosphate in the water, which you need for development of strong bones and teeth. It's a component of the enzyme system in a cell, which governs the release of energy. And it assists with, so it's part of ATP, you know, adenosine triphosphate. Assists with protein production, defines the structure of cell DNA and RNA, and you need DNA and RNA to build structure and to give you a blueprint for what you're going to make out of your cells. And it also helps to maintain the neutrality of body fluid. So phosphate is used as a buffer. So you don't, so it buffers you so you're not too acid or alkaline. So I thought that was really cool that you could go to the hot springs, you could benefit from sitting in the hot spring water, and you could drink it while you're there, and then they have, for part of your fee, you get a free spigot, and you could bring a jug and bring it home. I just had a water bottle, so I put it in my water bottle, and I had a really delightful experience. Eric has two children. He has three children. One of them is grown in a way. That's why I said two. So Rune is already out of the house because he's 22. But he has two younger children, Rosie and Raiden. And so I gave Rosie some of the water to try. And she's 13 years old. And I thought she'd be picky because she's 13. She tasted the water. And she was really, it was such a pleasure that this young woman to give her things to try because she was so adventurous. She tried the hot spring water. She looked at me and she said, "I like this. This water tastes clean. It's really good. It's really clean." I said, "But does it taste like sulfur?" She said, "I can't taste the sulfur. It just tastes clean." One of the things that I noticed while I was there is, at Eric's house, he lives in the city of Vancouver, and so they have city water, and the water is chlorinated, and you can taste the chlorine. So he has a Brita filter, but the filter only does so well at getting rid of the chlorine. So I think in the places where Rosie lives, both in her house in Portland and the house in Vancouver, they're using city water and they can only filter it so much. Although Eric did say they had a much more effective filter in the house in Portland. So, but you know, if she's drinking city water, that water, the water from the hot spring, is going to taste a lot cleaner. And the neat thing is from that spigot, it wasn't terribly sulfur tasting, but it definitely tasted soft. I shouldn't say soft. It tasted smooth, like there were minerals in it. So if you drink that water regularly, it's a nice way to deliver small amounts of minerals into your system. So it was really neat to have. So how can you take a mineral bath in your house? Well, you would have to get, probably dead sea salts. That would be one way to get lots of minerals into your water to get some kind of mineral spring water. But if you purchase dead sea salts and you put them in your bath, you're going to get a somewhat similar experience to taking a bath in a hot spring. It's not going to be the same. And if you ever have the opportunity to visit mineral springs, it's a nice idea to do that. And you can go up to New York, because Saratoga Springs has mineral springs up there, and there are spas you can go to and bathe in the mineral water up there, and you don't have to fly to the West Coast. But if you do go to Oregon or Washington, there are opportunities to go to various hot springs, and you can look online, and there's loads of them. And the ones I've been to Carson, and I've been to Wind River also in the past. I have been to Cougar, which is also known as Terwilliger, and I've been to Bagby. And I think that's it. Those are the ones that we used to go to. We used to take day trips and go to either Bagby or Cougar was our favorite. Oh, and also Brighton Bush Hot Springs. Brighton Bush is a resort, and it's a neat little resort where they have hot spring pools that are both, that they have sort of more naturally oriented ones, and then they have some that are that are just concrete, but they bring the hot spring water into those pools and you can sit in them, and they have different temperatures of them, and that's nice. And Brighton Bush also, it's a resort and you can stay in cabins, and the cabins and the outbuildings at Brighton Bush are heated with hot spring water. They run the pipes under the buildings, and that's how they heat the buildings. And the heat is so wonderful. It's so enveloping and warm and lovely. And it's really different than having, forced air heat from oil that's forcing air through your house. But it's really, really nice. So what I wanted to segue into is why hydrotherapy is good for you. So hydrotherapy, water helps to increase circulation, increases blood flow through the organs of detoxification, your skin, your liver, your kidneys, your lymphatics, and your digestive system. And so you can also, the other thing you can put in your baths, I already mentioned dead sea salts. You can add essential oils. You can add various herbs. So you could put calming herbs in your bath, like lavender or skullcap or hops, into your bathtub. So it's like you're taking a bath in tea. I would guess you can also, if you're very, if you're having trouble with allergies, you can put nettles in your bathtub. And if you get nettles, once the nettles are in hot water, nettles are not going to sting you. And, of course, if you're buying dried nettles, they've already been taken care of, so they're not going to bother you. And you might get some benefit that way from allergies and itching and things like that, because they have antihistamine properties. And then Epsom salts are lovely. Epsom salts are just magnesium sulfate. So Epsom salts are very nice. The nice thing about Epsom salts is when you get in the water, the magnesium interacts with the nerves that are right on the surface of your skin. So it helps you to calm down right away. And if there is any absorption, you're going to get some detoxifying benefits as well. There are different hydrotherapies that we do as naturopathic physicians, or that we can do, or that we instruct you to do. There's the constitutional hydrotherapy. When we did it in school, we used to put galvanic on your tummy and then on your back, if you're lying on your back.
Galvanic? What's that?
It's an electrotherapy. It's an electrostimulation therapy, and it's to stimulate circulation in those areas. So when you're lying on your back, we put on your tummy, and when you're lying on your tummy, we put on your back. And so constitutional hydrotherapy is you have 5 minutes of a hot towel followed by 10 minutes of a cold towel, and your job is to warm that cold towel up. The hot is just to prepare you for the cold towel. And the healing aspect comes from warming up the cold towel. And if someone else is doing it to you, they apply it. You're on a wool blanket covered in a sheet, and then you lie on that sheet, and the person puts the hot towel on your chest for 5 minutes, followed by 10 minutes of a hot towel, of a cold towel, and then you flip over and 5 minutes hot, 10 minutes cold on your back, and you're all wrapped up in the sheet and the blanket while this is going on. And if you do those, you know, no more, you don't need to do them more than 5 days a week, but if you do them regularly, they can help your immune system to improve. And if you're by yourself and you want to do a constitutional hydrotherapy, then what you do is you take a nice hot shower, make sure you're nice and warm for at least 10 minutes, and then you get a cold towel that's big enough to wrap around your whole body, your front and back, your torso, your whole torso, front and back. And then you wrap that around yourself, and then you have a sheet and a sheet lying over a wool blanket, and then you wrap yourself up in that, and you lie there for 20 minutes. So that's a constitutional hydrotherapy. There are different kinds of saunas, dry sauna. I got to experience sauna when I was there, when I went to a health club, and they had a dry sauna there. And that seemed to be the thing that I really needed, the dry heat, because I felt so damp. So in the dry sauna, it's just nice and heating, and it increases circulation, increases immunity, increases circulation to the skin and in and out. And if you, of course, if you alternate with cold for any of those things, so if you're in a sauna and you're able to get out and splash yourself with cold water, or if you're in Scandinavia, roll in the snow, going back and forth between the hot and the cold is very good for you. It helps to flush the circulation in and out of your body. Far infrared sauna is a specific kind of sauna that has heating rays at the far end of the infrared spectrum, very long heat waves, and they penetrate your body very nicely. And again, they're antimicrobial. They can promote healing. They can promote healing of joints and bones and muscles, and help, you know, provide and help you with detoxification to your organs. If you go in a dry sauna that's just in a health club, it's not the same as far. It's probably not far infrared. Far infrared is something you have to get specially. And you can get far infrared sauna. You can also buy far infrared heating pads that you can put on specific parts. We have one. I bought one. Yeah. So then
I didn't
there's
know that.
Yeah, then there's steam. So Eric took me to the steam room at the Y, the Clark County Y, and that was nice. Although I found that my tolerance, it was hard for me to tolerate that as well. Because it was wet heat and it's very steamy and you get very warm. The issue with the steam is you're going to get a lot hotter, because when you sweat, there's nowhere for it to go. So you're just going to get a lot hotter. So you have to have a tolerance for that. And I found that, you know, I have a pretty good tolerance for sweating during exercise. But usually when I'm sweating during exercise, like if I'm indoors, I have a towel, I have a fan on me. And if I'm outdoors, again, you have the wind blowing on you. So your sweat is constantly being taken from you. It becomes more difficult when you have a hot, steamy day. But, you know, by the time you, for me, I've noticed that by the time I have a hot, steamy day, I've been exercising enough that I've built up a tolerance to it. I didn't have a good tolerance for this, and I had to keep getting out and cooling off and I noticed that Eric had a better tolerance for the steam because he was used to it. But when I got into the sauna, I was able to tolerate that a lot better because there wasn't the steam. Then there's the hot fomentation treatment, which is a great heating treatment for the body. Again, you lay out a wool blanket and a towel over it, and then the person, you want to heat the person up a great deal. And this is great when the person is sick, they have a cold or a flu, especially if they have a bronchitis or pneumonia, and if they're able to tolerate it. So the person has their feet on heat, whether it's a hot foot bath or a heating pad. They have their back on heat, usually with a hot pack. And then the person's laid out on a wool blanket with a sheet, and then hot towels are brought to them and placed on the chest. So you do, and then they wrap them up in the wool blanket and sheet, and you do that for 3 minutes. Then you open up and you do another session of a 3 minutes hot towel. Then you open up again, just on the chest, and then you scrub the chest down with a cold mitten friction, just a washcloth, and you scrub the chest with cold. The person's head is always in cold. Whenever you're doing a heating treatment, it's a good idea to put cold to the head so you don't get a headache and excessive circulation to the head. And I found that I had to do that when I was in the hot spring bath. I had to put cold to my head. I felt better when I did that. So the person's head is always in cold, and you provide them with water to drink during the treatment. If they get thirsty, you want to give them water. And so you do three rounds of that, 3 minutes hot, 3 minutes cold mitten friction. At the end of the third round, instead of just scrubbing the chest, you just remove the blankets from them and you scrub their whole body down. And that's the hot fomentation treatment. I have seen it turn bronchitis and pneumonia around. Why we didn't do that when I was sick? We should have done it when I was sick.
Should have done that when you were sick.
Yeah, it's labor intensive, and you have to have a way to keep the towels hot. I mean, the way you make the washcloths is you put a couple of washcloths in an ice bath, and if you can keep the ice bath going, you just keep switching out the towels, you know, and you do one washcloth goes on the head, the other, and you keep checking the one that's on the head. You flip it over when it gets warm. You throw it in the ice bath, and you take the other one out. And then you can use the other washcloth that's in the ice bath to do the cold mitten friction. So you have that going. But then you have to have a source for the hot towels. So what we used to do at the naturopathic colleges, we used to microwave them.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we used to wet them and microwave them.
I was going to say, do they have to be wet or not? Because you could put them in a hot tub of water also.
Right, that's what you'd have to do. You have to put them in a hot tub of water, but the water has to be kept hot.
Right.
But if you can do it, it's great. So the other thing is simply alternating hot and cold, and you can do this with alternating hot and cold washcloths, you know, to specific parts of your body. You can do that on your back. You can do that on the ear. If you have an ear infection, you can do it across your sinuses when you can't get your neti pot to go through. So 3 minutes hot, 30 seconds cold, and you alternate, and that's great. Sitz baths as well, 3 minutes hot, 30 seconds cold. So for people who have prostate issues or people who have hemorrhoids, you know, or people who just want to improve their pelvic circulation. So if you have any kind of menstrual issues, sitz baths can be great. Even if you want to improve your digestion, sitz baths can be great. So the sitz bath is you're sitting in water, basically from the middle of your thighs to your waist, and that's it. And so, again, 3 minutes hot, 30 seconds cold. There can be stuff in the sitz bath or not. So, like, if you have hemorrhoids and you want to put Epsom salts in the bath, you can do that. But you can do Epsom salts anyway in the bath. That's an option. You can put witch hazel in the bath, again, if you have hemorrhoids. Or you could just do a straight-up bath. That's fine, any which way. Then hot foot baths. And hot foot baths can be something that you do, you know, again, when you're sick, when you want to improve circulation. And you're just basically putting the feet in a hot foot bath for 20 to 30 minutes. The person is all wrapped up and they have cold to the head. Paraffin baths. So you get a contraption that you put wax in and the wax melts. And that's great for specific joints. So if you have, you know, arthritis in your hands, you stick the hand, you make a candle out of your hand, you put your hand in, you take it out, you put it in, you take it out, and the warm wax feels really good. So you leave the hand in the nice warm wax, and then when it's done, you take the wax off and you make a little ball, and the person can squeeze on it and do physical therapy with it, and they're going to feel better doing the physical therapy because the warm wax just really loosens up the joints. It feels really good.
The warm wax doesn't burn you?
No, you don't make it hot enough to burn.
But it's got to be hot enough to be melted.
That's right.
Okay.
So it's okay. Yeah.
Okay.
And then remember to just drink water. That's hydrotherapy. Drinking water and also doing neti pots. Those are forms of hydrotherapy. So you want to make sure you're well hydrated in general. So there you go. So we got two nice topics today. We talked about delivery systems for natural hormone replacement therapy. And I was inspired by going to Carson Hot Springs to talk to you about water and hydrotherapy and how water can be beneficial. And I just want to also remind you that just going swimming in natural bodies of swimming in general, if all you got is a swimming pool with chlorine in it, I still think that that's a good thing. That, you know, I tell people who are like, I can't move because I have this or that joint that hurts me. Well, water therapy is always great, and if you have to be in chlorine, then so be in chlorine, and then find nice soaps to wash the chlorine off of yourself with. I mean, I go swimming in the pool at the Mansfield Community Center, and they use chlorine, and I still find it very beneficial, and I just clean myself off of the chlorine. But if you can go swimming in natural bodies of water whenever you can, it's always good for you. You're going to get negative ions, which are going to be anti-inflammatory for you. If you can bathe in the ocean, there's minerals in the ocean, which is really great. Obviously, if you can bathe in a hot spring pool, they also have a hot spring pool at Carson Hot Springs. That's like a swimming, not really swimming pool. I mean, you just kind of hang it, but it's like a pool with a deck, like a normal pool that you can sit in. And has mineral spring water for an extra fee. I didn't want to stay long enough to do that because I wanted to go to Multnomah Falls. But also being around water, just like I visited Multnomah Falls, when you're around agitated water, like a waterfall or white water, it's kicking up negative ions for you and any minerals that are around. So you're going to benefit from that. So visiting, even if you don't go in it, visiting agitated water is a really good thing. So that's another form of hydrotherapy. So if you can bathe in a natural body of water, whether a lake, a river, a stream, or in the ocean, that's really good for you. And even just being around it. Like I try to exercise nearby. Like I'll route a bike ride near a body of water because I enjoy that. And I think, you know, it's good for you physically. All right. So that is Radio Naturopath for this early spring day, April 3rd. I hope you enjoy the spring weather that is coming. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath. It's a call and talk show about health and natural medicine. I'm Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician, with my co-host Ron Meniza. You can also email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to this show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org. You can also leave questions or comments at my Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram at Fran Storch, ND. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores.